Last Word on Today FM.
So for the week trending, we have Lorcan Nine, Head of Training at the Communications Clinic. But first from our own Today FM newsroom, Emily Keegan, tell us please about this analysis that has been done about marriages in Ireland over the decade between 2014 and 2024.
Yeah, so these are new figures from the Central Statistics Office, which show that there's been a 7.7% decline in the number of marriages within those 10 years. I think the biggest thing that was catching people's attention is the shift from Catholic weddings to civil ceremonies. So in 2014, Catholic weddings were the most common marriage type. There was 13,071 of them, but they fell in the decade by almost 51% to 6,425. There's been a lot of talk
about this. That's how many there were in 2024, half of what it had been in 2014.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of talk about that, but I don't really know why people are so surprised. Like, if anyone's been going to weddings in recent years, I think you would know that it probably is far more common for people to be going down the civil or the humanist route with them. And I think a lot of it also is to do with accessing the church as well. It's a bit easier to have your wedding in the same venue that you're going to do the after party.
The last couple of weddings I've been at have exactly been that. It's the wedding out on the lawn, if the weather's good enough, or if the weather isn't good enough, there's a hall inside, and then you move from that into the reception.
It's easier. It saves so much time. It means you can start later in the day as well, because you don't have to then commute from the church to the venue. Also, the venues decorate themselves really nicely. Like, there's a lot of pros to it. And I know people have been saying perhaps more people would go down the Catholic route if priests were allowed to have the wedding at the venue. I don't really necessarily know if that's going to be the case, but I'm not surprised by these figures, to say the least.
What do you make of it, Lorcan? Oh, I think you're probably one of those who fell into the getting married in that decade category.
Probably, yeah. We did it in City Hall across the way, so we're part of the collapse in the Catholic marriage.
Sorry, can you not remember what year it was?
We don't need to get into that, Matt, right now.
Why, can you not remember?
It was about 6 years ago. What's that? So the numbers are significantly down. So yeah, you've gone from about six out of 10 people in Catholic marriage to about three out of 10. And yeah, it has been suggested that if you could bring the priest into the venue, well, then maybe people would go for the Catholic marriage. But that would obviously suggest that your commitment to the Catholic marriage is pretty skin deep. And I suppose it does point, I think, to the fact that Ireland have become a country of mainly cultural Catholics. So I think people still on the census describe
them. Convenience Catholics.
You can call it convenience Catholics. I actually think cultural Catholicism is fine. I mean, it's the faith you were brought up in. You might no longer believe. It's the old Dara O'Brien line of, I don't believe in God, still a Catholic. You know, there is that element of. And so if you're looking at 3 out of 10 marriages are Catholic, I don't think you would say only 3 out of 10 kids in Ireland are baptized, do their communion. So I think people are still attached there because there's no ceremony to replace it. People like really the idea of the baptism because of the day. They like the idea of the communion because of the day.
And they go to the church for it. They don't expect it to be brought to the hotel where they're having the reception.
Because there's no replacement for it while there is for a wedding. And so it's actually the rising, the Humanist Society is the one who's kind of taken over. The amount of civil registration has stayed basically the same. But the Humanist ceremonies have gone up by about 68%. There's an element then as well, where if you look and you look back on the stats, which I find interesting anyway, is that every 10 years, the average age of brides and grooms goes up 2 years. So if you go back to 2004 through to 2014 to 2024, the age has changed by about 2 years, where you're now looking at the average age to get married for the bride is about 36 and the groom is about 38, which does suggest that people are moving life kind of touch points later in life. And that's obviously part of a lot of the talk around, like, you know, lulls in birth rates rather than decreases in birth rates, that it's actually lulls in birth rate, that the birth rate will catch up. It's just people are doing everything later, whether that's because of, you know, kind of career preference or whether that's because people just feel ready later in life, whatever it might be for. So I think the marriage and the CSO giving us these stats gives us a really good insight into Irish culture.
Any more observations on that, Emily?
I think everything said there, I actually never even thought of the point about the baptisms and the communions, that there is no replacement for them. I think it's such a valid point. I never thought about it like that, that maybe if there was a replacement for them. And to be fair, people are doing it. They're doing these like naming ceremonies now with their children instead, where they like name the godparents, which can you call them godparents if they're also not baptised children?
But so, I think the baptism is important in many religions, not just Catholicism, for getting into denominational schools. And the point is, the vast majority of schools still are denominational. There are very few, by comparison, educate together or non-denominational schools.
No, absolutely.
But I also think there's a degree where parents do still, even if they are no longer practicing Catholics themselves, do like the idea of a Catholic education, because that is the education that they had. And I think there's an element here where, you know, religion replaces ritual, but ritual has predated religion. Like, there are rituals in people's lives that people like to mark, and the way we have done that here is through the Catholic religion. But I mean, what this shows is that when there are other options, people are more likely to suit themselves and to suit what they want to do. Okay, as long as they can still do the ritual.
Some very interesting comments coming in. Baptism and communion are about a commitment to the church and God. Marriage is a commitment to each other. Another listener has another suggestion. We were talking about convenience Catholics, or what did you call them?
Cultural.
Another one says bouncy castle Catholics.
That's great.
Which is a new one. I like that. Another one says, I do find weddings that aren't in a church don't have the same special vibe. Personal opinion, but you feel you are just at a party a few days after the document was signed.
Is that not what it is, though, really? Like, and I think that's what people want. Like, I know myself, whenever I do get married, that's what I want. I want a party. I don't want to be going in saying my Hail Marys. Sorry.
Another one says, I remember my father-in-law telling all his friends his daughter was having a naturalist wedding instead of a humanist wedding.
Oh, God.
Right?
Whatever people want to do on the day they're getting married, Matt, is absolutely fine.
Shane and Tala says, I got married in a beautiful hotel in County Wicklow. Dinner and dancing in the same venue. Perfect day. Well, that's right. Another one says, guessing the reason for later marriages, as in the average age you refer to, is the cost of getting on the property ladder. Weddings have been put off until such time as they have their feet under a table. I think that's been the way for a while now. Now, I want to move on to something else, Emily. The idea that in a restaurant that you would have a compulsory service charge. And, you know, it often happens, particularly in Irish restaurants, when you have a party of six and you have a compulsory service charge of 12.5% lamped on, which sometimes I say, well, should it be compulsory? Also, are you doing yourselves out of maybe might be a better tip if you'd had really good service where you might give 15%? But what's this idea Gordon Ramsay is bringing into his British restaurants of a 20% service charge?
Yeah, so 20% in some of his restaurants now. So he's put it in the high tips on at least two occasions at his Lucky Cat restaurant in Bishopsgate, in what are thought to be some of the first examples of it. Now, this was on New Year's Eve and around Christmas, so it would have been a time where you will have a lot of bookings and it will be really busy and your staff will be under increased pressure. And I suppose I can kind of see both sides of this, like being a former waitress, where if I had a party of six and they didn't tip, I would be annoyed because it's a lot of work, especially if they've got children who are colouring on the chairs and who are mashing food into the carpet and then they get up.
I'm bringing a lot of joy to everybody's life as a father of a young child who likes to go to restaurants. Lightening the mood for the entire restaurant, and I think, is what you mean.
Yeah, but they're more than welcome to come, absolutely. But
just give
you
a tenner.
Yeah, that's it. If you give me a tenner and then I'm happy out and that's it. Like, I can see why a service charge is added, but I also see your argument that you might be putting yourself out of a bigger tip, because I've also been on the other end of it where I go into a restaurant and I see they have a service charge on it and then I'm not going to tip on top of that and I'm not going to increase it. So you're getting whatever the percentage is. And I might not.
And what do
much.
You tip now? Because what used to be standard as 10% has become the options when you go to many places now are 12.5%, 15%, even 22%, like we're in the United States. And we've also had a recent introduction in Ireland, a thing like that I'd only seen previously in America, and I was only given out about it last year in the United States, that even if you go and get a coffee, a simple coffee, you pay the price for it, and you're actually asked, do you want to pay a tip on top of that? Yeah. And you're not even sitting down.
Yeah.
And you get to feel like a horrible person as you stare them in the eye and say, no tip, and move on. But absolutely, I don't think we should let that level of tipping culture come in, because what happens in the United States is that it's not on top of, it's instead of. So the employer pays less because there's an expectation that the tip will be there. So it's the employer who gets the saving, and it's not an additional for the person working there. There's an example here in the Gordon Ramsay story of a string of bars in Scotland who did an automatic 2% tip on every pint that you bought, that it was just baked in. I mean, that's no longer really a service charge because you're going up to the bar yourself.
That's just a price increase.
That's just a price increase dressed up as something else. So I think, I mean, people should absolutely tip, but the cultural norm here and around of the 12%, unless it's exceptional, in which then you can decide yourself to go up, is where it should be.
So Emily, what about the barista who is there? You're in a queue in a cafe and you order your coffee for takeaway. You're not going to sit down. And there is a thing comes up on the screen in front of you asking you whether you want to add a tip in. Would you be embarrassed like Lorcan clearly is to hit a zero and run?
I would be, yeah.
So you're going to pay another 10 or 15% for your coffee?
I do it.
You do that?
Yeah, I know. I tip. I say no tip and I'm embarrassed about it, but I do it. But it also depends. So I think what Americans kind of have lost sight of is you're tipping for the service, but they're tipping regardless of whether the service was good or not. And that's the thing. If I'm in a coffee shop and the barista is absolutely flat out and I can see that other people are being maybe rude or dismissive, I will feel bad for them. And then if they're nice to me, I absolutely will tip because I think they deserve it. They're flat to the mat and they're still...
But you might have tipped them before they actually deliver you your coffee, which they could spill as they're giving it to you, and you've already given them the tip.
But that isn't that human error? And aren't we all allowed to make mistakes?
Well, actually, can I ask you so as well, when your time is waiting, interesting. How often do parents, when they have a screaming child at the table, take the child out to do their shouting and roaring outside rather than indulging them at the table when others, perhaps sitting elsewhere, aren't as impressed by other people's children's screaming?
You just want me to roil up all the texters now, don't you?
No, I'm just asking a question of what your experience as a waitress, what used to happen?
I would say they very rarely took them out, but I'm also not going to begrudge the parents for that most of the time because I understand they've got their hands full and it's difficult. And I do think also if people are going out and they're eating in restaurants, you need to expect that there will be children there, like they're allowed out in normal society and it might get loud at times. But tip your waiters.
What about you, Lorcan? Should adults, if they have a child who is upset or throwing a tantrum or anything like that, should they pick the child up and bring them outside rather than leaving them at the table?
It goes without saying that my child is perfect and I would never do such a thing because she is very, very well behaved and great at everything that she does. I think actually kids do need to be allowed in adult spaces, obviously like to a degree, but like, I mean, you need to be, kids need to be around life, like they can't be taken away from life and then suddenly by the age of 12, 13, 14, 15, suddenly supposed to be able to adapt in those environments. And I think parents should be allowed still engage with life. But I think common sense prevails. I mean, if they're given out for a minute or two and you're doing your best to calm them down, everybody chill out. If it's 10 minutes and they're ruining everybody's day, one of you get up and walk outside. I think that's common sense. That's common courtesy. That's common respect. But to reiterate, my child has never done any such a thing.
I don't know how many of our listeners maybe have been in the United States, have travelled with Jet2. It's an American airline, isn't it?
Or is it's it? EU.
Oh, is it an EU one? Sorry, okay.
I'm just thinking, isn't the Jess Glynn song, that viral thing, Nothing Beats a Jet2 Holiday, that was kind of UK-based, I think.
So all right, okay.
That's what I'm leaning on.
Right, okay. But maybe then it's maybe preempted Michael O'Leary by coming up with the idea of a database for disruptive passengers so yobs can be banned from every airline. Tell us more about this, Emily.
Yeah, so it comes after a flight was forced to divert following what's been described as a vicious brawl, and two holidaymakers were banned for life from the Jet2 services. So basically, videos have actually been shared online, I believe, of this incident where there's a man who appears to be very intoxicated and he's on the flight and he starts fighting with the cabin crew. He ends up actually assaulting a member of the cabin crew. The pilot tries to intervene to calm things down. To no avail. An innocent bystander on the flight ends up a woman in her 60s was actually accidentally hit after the passenger and another traveller on board got involved in the fight. So, like, sounds like the flight from hell. This person also had children with him, two young children, who I can only imagine how upsetting that was for them to witness as well. So I can see where Jet2 are coming from with this because they're calling for the database for these people to be listed on so that then when they go to book any flight in the future, you can see that they've been banned from an airline. And I think that makes perfect sense. If you have been involved in a level of disruption where you've actually injured people, I don't see why any airline would want to have you on any of their flights. And I think they should be made aware of that when you're booking.
Yeah, I've just been told Jet2 is British, JetBlue is American. That's what I was confusing it for. And this flight was going from Turkey to Gatwick. But apparently the person involved in this, Lorcan, was Irish, or self-identified as Irish.
Yeah, well, yeah, one of the things they said was, I'm ready now, I need this, I'm Irish, as he was squaring up, I think, to a cabin crew member as part of this. I suppose it poses two questions. One is the Michael O'Leary thing of restricting alcohol in the airport before flights. So that was his idea, which is there should be a limit on how much you can drink before you get on the flight, because these people came onto the flight already drunk, which would suggest maybe they should have been stopped getting onto the flight in the first place. Of course, Michael Leary doesn't say we should restrict the amount of alcohol you can buy on his flights, because that's his purchases rather than the airports. But obviously the idea of people being very, very drunk and boisterous on flights, it doesn't always end in escalated to a fight, but it can be very unpleasant for people and families in particular who are on those flights. So the idea of alcohol and flying is part of it. And then I suppose the idea of a register does raise the question of, you know, how much of a right is the right to fly? You know, how much of it is that, you know, airlines should be able to make choices about their customers, I suppose, their passengers they bring on. How much of a restriction is that on people and people's ability to travel for other things that they might need to travel for afterwards? And then who makes that decision? Should it be up to a state to make that decision, or should the airlines themselves be able to come together? I don't know where I fall on that question, but it is definitely a specific question where, you know, the state can take your driving license, but in this sense, is it the airlines who can take your capacity to fly away from you? And it's an interesting question. I probably would think a register, as long as it was tightly controlled and regulated, might not be the worst idea.
Okay, a lot of people coming in on the issue of the tipping, and pointing out that the wages for restaurant staff and bar staff in the United States are a lot lower than they are here with our minimum wage, and that people over there depend on the tips for their livelihoods, whereas here we have a higher minimum wage and therefore we shouldn't necessarily tip as much as they do in the United States.
They clean up over there, because when I was on my J1, one of the girls I lived with was working in a restaurant, and she could make like upwards of $600 a night if it was a busy night. So like,
and there was a reason why one of Donald Trump's big policies in the last election was the no tax on tips policy, for that exact reason, that it was seen as additional income, and it was a big vote getter for him.
Listener says that individual said, "I'm Irish in an English accent." So anyway, right, tell us about the lipstick index, Emily.
Yeah, so this basically is a way that they're trying to measure, I suppose, things like inflation and consumer sentiment. And it basically kind of in a nutshell says that when people can't afford big luxuries in life, when times are getting tough like they are right now, when the world is very uncertain about what's going to happen with the war in Iran, and money might start being a little bit tighter, they start to spend their money on smaller luxuries instead. So lipstick is used as an example of that, because lipstick is quite inexpensive, but it's still like you're treating yourself. You're going into shop and you're buying yourself a lipstick. Now,
is it inexpensive?
It depends where you're buying it from. I mean, you can go in and buy certain brands Penny's have their own brand that probably costs €2 for a lipstick, but then you can also go and buy like Louis Vuitton, which I think might be like €70 for a lipstick. So it depends what brand you're buying it from.
Is there much difference apart from the price?
I would always buy the cheaper one, because I don't think there's enough of a difference to justify that price. But also, maybe if I had more disposable income, I'd buy Louis Vuitton all the time. Maybe I actually just haven't been exposed to the luxury.
Sorry, is there more lipstick been purchased anyway just because of all the influencers on Instagram and TikTok who are recommending it?
This is an interesting thing. So in an article in the Business Post, it's saying that the trend has been observed by an Irish cosmetic company, Cash Beauty, who has reported a 75% increase in lipstick sales. Now, I would be part of Cash Beauty's, I suppose, target demographic of people who would be buying from them. It's run by an influencer. She was a major influencer before she actually set up the company. And I am aware of the fact that they launched a lip stain in recent months towards the end of the year. So I would imagine that's a huge factor. And it's actually been said here, the growth was boosted by the launch of their new lip stain at the end of 2025, which sold 150,000 units to date. So,
sorry, what's the difference between a lip stain and a lipstick?
A lip stain is more like a marker. So it will, like, a lipstick would wipe off easily. A lip stain, like, actually stains your lips. It'll stay there for hours.
So don't get it on your clothes.
Yeah, or your hands or anything. Like, it can even stain. Now, it washes off after a while. Like, it's not a permanent marker, but it's tougher. But I would imagine things like that are driving it more so than anything else. I've seen this lip stain everywhere. Everyone I follow online is posting about it. Even people I don't follow, ads are everywhere. So I would imagine that's a bit of a factor in it as well. I don't know how much we can rely on this theory.
Okay. Tell us about the giant digital statue for Dublin, Lorcan.
So there is a proposal for a massive giant digital statue. It's on George's Quay. People will remember that there was a big controversy about the whitewater rafting facility that was going to come into Dublin. The proposal is to go there. It's a massive giant statue where you can impose your face on it so that the statue looming over Dublin and the size of the Liberty Hall will be your face. So we get to see every stag that ever comes to Dublin looming over us all. The example they use is James Joyce, which is, imagine, definitely what people will pick when it comes into it, a picture of James Joyce. It's the brainchild of an entrepreneur who's involved in the Dublin Wax Museum and was involved in Temple Bar, and he's describing it as an attempt to give back to Dublin because it's a wasted space. It is effectively something that would be massively expensive, would be purely for tourists, and I think is an incredibly bad idea. We don't need something in a key space in Dublin that could be used as a community facility and then also be good for tourism and economy. That's basically a tourist pull once again. The whitewater rafting facility was ridiculed consistently when it came up as an idea. And yet, the idea of the whitewater rafting facility was you could bring stags and hens and they could use it. You could also use it for elite sport and you could also use it for your community. And I firmly believe the reason why that was ridiculed as much as it was because people could not wrap their head around the fact that somebody in the inner city of Dublin might want to be in a canoe and might want to do whitewater rafting. There was nothing at all wrong with that idea. There's also nothing at all wrong with the idea of maybe making it a communal swimming pool. There is something wrong with the idea of taking this prime area in probably the most grown area of Dublin and making it a big tourist attraction that we do not need.
One last one, Emily, I want you to tell us about. I wonder how many people have seen the video of the FIFA boss Gianni Infantino trying to force the head of the Palestine Football Federation to shake hands with his Israeli counterpart.
Yeah, it's a bit of an uncomfortable watch, to say the least. Of course, he did this after he confirmed his intention to stand for a re-election for a third full term next year as FIFA president. So, like, I think he was kind of envisioning this as a way to make himself look good, that he can bring all these countries together and it's going to be very positive if he's re-elected to that position. It backfired. Like, it's honestly so awkward. He's trying to basically drag over the Palestinian Football Association's president, Jabril Rajoub, I hope I pronounced that right, over to the Israel FA's vice president, and he's not going. He doesn't want to go, understandably so. Why would he want to shake that man's hand? Think about what's going on in Gaza right now. It backfired on him. It's very awkward. I can see why it's doing the rounds. It's worth watching, just honestly, to kind of sit in the uncomfortableness that he must have felt himself. He's kind of condescending in a way, the way he's kind of trying to bring him over almost like a child. I can't see how that's going
to
help.
I think he wants
campaign.
To be in a position to and award himself next year's FIFA yes. World Peace Prize, the one he gave to Trump last year. We got to leave it there. Thank you very much, Emily Keegan and Lorcan Nyan, for being with us here on The Last Word of Today FM.
The Last Word on Today FM.